In this lecture, we want to deal with the eschatology of victory in Afrikaner education, arts, race relations, and economics. Now, approaching the field of education, we need to be reminded that the Heidelberg Catechism of 1562, one of the three documents that governs Afrikaner church outlook and Afrikaner Calvinist outlook to this day, in its exposition of the fourth commandment, requires God's people to maintain the schools. In other words, if you're a Calvinist, you are involved in education in terms of the fourth commandment. I can see this to some extent, though perhaps one could put it also under the fifth commandment, honoring your father and mother and raising your children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. At any rate, with this tremendous emphasis upon the necessity of education, the first South African Calvinist, from the word go, with the establishment of the Cape Colony in 1652, did indeed educate. And not only educate, but the Dutch East India Company garrison at the Cape would also supply the school books and make school training facilities available to all of the colonists at the Cape, in which the church and the church's officials, and notably the preachers, were also involved. What you have then from 1652 with the establishment of the Cape Colony, right down through the British occupation of the Cape in 1800, is a system of Christian national schools in which the church played a big role, but it was not a system of church schools as such, but a system of public schools, Calvinist public schools, in which the church played a considerable role. But of course, with the British takeover of the Cape in 1800, by 1820, the whole character of the public school system had been changed, had been de-Calvinized, much to the grief of the South African Calvinists who had not been used to this new kind of public education that was coming in. This, too, was one of the fundamental causes of the Great Trek, in terms of which they moved away from the Cape, taking with them a large number of school teachers and preachers, and setting up mobile Christian national schools while they were on the ox wagon, as they moved further and further into the interior of Africa. A school where there was a perfect balance between theory, derived ultimately from the Bible, and practice derived from hunting game and defending themselves as they continued to extend the frontier. Already from 1750 through 1800, there had been growing supranaturalistic rationalism in the schools, and indeed, especially in the Cape Colony, after the departure of the Voortrekkers in 1836 through 1900, statism and humanism, though never anything like as blatant as it is in the United States or in Europe today, was expanding its control over the public school system. Yet notwithstanding that, even at that time, the church still continued to exercise a tremendous influence over the schools, even in the Cape, as we saw in the case of Andrew Murray a little earlier. Round about 1900, the Fremantle Commission met in the Cape and revealed the state of public education, which had worsened steadily in the Cape during the past century. As far as the South African Calvinist republics were concerned to the north, the short-lived Natal Republic and the long-lived Orange Free State Republic and Transvaal Republics, of course, Christian national public education was the rule there, and inspectors of education had been established, always strong Calvinists, often Calvinist preachers appointed by the state to monitor the quality of education in the Calvinist schools at that time. But with the defeat by Britain of the Orange Free State Republic and the South African Republic in 1902, the system of non-Christian statist public education was extended even into those conquered territories. At this point, some of the more conservative Afrikaner Christian parents in those areas retreated from the new character of the public education system and established Christian national education in a system of private schools, separate from the state school system, competing against the separate school system for the first time ever in the history of South Africa. These, at this stage, were generally church schools, meeting on church property and taught by church personnel. But from 1910 and 1914 onward, with the unification of South Africa, and then with the agreement being made to allow each province or state to do its own thing in the area of state education, and with the emergence even then, and ever increasingly thereafter, of Calvinist dedicated school teachers consecrating their lives to work for the Calvinistic reconquest of the public school system, it became more and more of an option to work within the public education system so that the Christian national schools, the private schools that had grown up after the defeat of the South Africans and the South African War, began to wilt away. What we then find from 1910 onward is a separate education system for each state, one in which Christianity in general and Calvinism in particular slowly began to reconquer. It took almost 50 years to engineer its complete reconquest, but the Calvinists finally succeeded. Already in the 1920s, the University of Potchefstroom for Christian Higher Education was created by private act of Congress. This enabled a university to exist in South Africa, a publicly recognized public university, which was thoroughly Calvinistic and which could refuse to employ anyone, and did, who would not undertake to teach his specialty subject from a strongly Calvinistic life and world perspective. It is at this time that Hendrik Stoker, the great South African philosopher, began to teach, and it started in a small way. Let this be an encouragement to you all. Stoker's teaching load in the 1920s, you ready for this, was 50 hours a week. I've been teaching 25 hours in about 7 or 8 or 9 days, and I'm pretty tired by now. But can you imagine teaching 50 hours a week? It almost seems impossible, but Stoker did it. But then, of course, Stoker is some individual. And we find, too, the increasing re-Calvinization of the other universities. University of Stellenbosch, that had always been strongly Calvinistic since its establishment in the 19th century, but which had to some extent slipped away from that, but not to a great extent, became increasingly re-Calvinized. So that if you go to the University of Stellenbosch today, you'll find the most prestigious university in South Africa, a real Ivy League university steeped in tradition, where nearly all of the students, thousands and thousands and thousands of them, attend Calvinist church worship every Sunday, and in which a very large slice of the students are involved in missionary work every Sunday afternoon, in taking the gospel to non-white peoples not very far from the university and sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ with them. I know when Oswald Smith and later Paul Smith, neither of them Calvinists, but both of them evangelicals, visited the University of Stellenbosch, They said they have never been to any place in the world where they'd found so many young people committed to the extension of the kingdom of Christ as at that university. Also, Stellenbosch has to this day by far the largest number of students of its membership of any university in the world, proportionately, involved in Christian outreach groups. I know of no other situation anywhere else. So then, so much for Stellenbosch University. And some of the younger universities, this is also very pronounced, the Orange Free State University, where I took my second doctorate, is very largely a Calvinist university, where more and more the process is to restrict the new appointments of the professors only to those who are professing Calvinists, with excellent faculties of theology and of philosophy and of history and of education, all of them teaching exclusively from a Calvinistic perspective. So too the Rand Afrikaans University, one of the newest in South Africa, and to an increasing extent the University of Port Elizabeth, and so forth. Well, from 1930 through 1960, the Calvinist educationalists organized underground to emerge in the 60s, and finally, with the approval of Congress and toward the 70s, to recapture control of public education from kindergarten through the PhD level, ever increasingly at the South African universities. The real turning point in all of this was 1948, when the National Party of Dr. Malan, that was the preacher turned politician, remember, gained the victory at the polls, and the very next week, the Bible was being read in the public schools throughout the land, which it hadn't been done before then. I remember it vividly, seeing I was about 14 years or 15 years of age at the time. Since then, courses and degrees in Bible studies, biblical studies, have been developed at the universities more and more, so that quite apart from theology courses which are offered, specifically to train preachers for the pulpit, you can also major today in biblical studies, which are not designed to prepare you for a preaching ministry, but which are designed to give you at least a bachelor's degree for a bachelor's degree majoring in biblical studies, and more a master's degree in biblical studies, to enable you to become a full-time Bible teacher in the public education system in South Africa. As a matter of fact, the catalogs of the South African universities are more and more offering these majors in biblical studies, which seems to me to be rather unique in the world today. And so, Bible is now being taught for credit at the public schools, from kindergarten right through what would be in America 10th or 12th grade, and there on out at the universities, at least to the master's level now, and I think soon to the PhD level. Organizations and conventions of all Christians are regularly held discussing matters of educational importance, and where not only is the Bible now being taught as a subject for credit in the public schools, but you're more and more finding, now that the freedom has been recaptured, a determined effort being made to rethink the curriculum in the other areas, such as history, geography, mathematics, at the public school, and to restructure them more and more in terms of a Christian life and worldview. Well, of course, if you don't like all of this Calvinism being increasing at the public school system, you're perfectly free to leave the public schools and start your own atheistic private school. And there are some, but not many, cases of that taking place in South Africa. Three of the larger, powerful Calvinist educational organizations in South Africa working at the national level to infiltrate the whole of culture are COFSA, that is the Teachers Association of South, the Calvinist Teachers Association of South Africa, the VCHO, the Association for Christian Higher Education, and the SAVCW, the South African Association for the Promotion of Christian Scholarship. And I myself have membership in the latter two of those organizations. In 1961, the Constitution of the United the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa was formally adapted after the Republican referendum. And as my memory serves me, the preamble runs roughly as follows: in humble acknowledgement to Almighty God, who has assembled our ancestors from a variety of countries, who has led us through many perils, who has maintained us in this land in a remarkable way, we the people do hereby establish the Republic of South Africa. The educational system of this country shall be Christian, and so on and so forth. This gave a tremendous impact to the development of education within South Africa. Well, some of the more important Calvinist educationalists in South Africa are the aged J. Chris Coetzee, that is C-O-E-T-Z-E-E, who has written many important books, First Principles in Our Calvinistic Education and Nourishment, his book Calvinism and Education, his book Education and Sex. He was professor of education at the University of Potchefstroom. Also the rector, or we would say in America, the president of the University of Potchefstroom, Professor Henny Bingle, B-I-N-G-L-E, with his books, National Culture and the Future, Education and Training in the Kingdom of God on Earth, and his book, The University in the Crucible. I'm giving you the English equivalents of the Afrikaans titles of these never-translated books. Also, Professor Dr. N.T. van Loggerenberg, V-A-N-L-O-G-G-E-R-E-N-B-E-R-G, head of the Department of Education at the Orange Free State University, who has written many manuals in the field of Christian education. My friend Dr. Marnie Malan, M-A-L-A-N, whose doctoral dissertation is a critical Calvinistic examination of the existentialistic educational methodology of Professor Oberholzer. Other friends, Professor Dr. Henry Stone, S-T-O-N-E, and Professor Dr. Pitt Heiberg, H-E-I-B-E-R-G, respectively the professors of education at the chairs of the Transvaal Teachers Training College on the White Waters Rand, and the Afrikaans professor of the Black University of the North near Pietersburg in the Transvaal province. And so then, we see the further development of education. In 1975, the University of Potchefstroom for Christian Higher Education created and hosted the world's first international conference of Calvinistic higher academicians. At their own expense, the university's expense, not the South African government's expense, delegates were flown in from some 19 countries, including 6 or 7 from the United States, of which I was one, and we met there for some 1 or 2 weeks discussing problems and approaches of the extension of Calvinism at the university level in all of our several countries. We had people there from England, Scotland and Ireland, France and Germany, United States and Canada, Korea and Japan, and most of the black countries in Africa south of the Sahara. It was quite a meeting, and it went very well indeed. This led to the second international conference that was held some years after that at Grand Rapids, and as a result of that, one would hope that the outreach will continue into all of the areas of the world. Now, the problems that face South Africa in the Calvinization of the educational institutions of its people are, of course, the very large non-Christian element of the population once you leave the white groups. There are perhaps still at least half of the black people of South Africa, who constitute 64% of the total population, who are unbaptized. Then you have a very large and influential slab of white Jews. You also have your Indian population, only 3% of whom have ever been baptized, most of whom are Hindus, and the rest are Muslims. And you can imagine that trying to expand a national education system, utilizing the languages of these different groups rather than utilizing Afrikaans in their case, meets with some resistance from these people who pay no lip service to Christianity, still less to Calvinism. And so some of the problems that have been reached involve granting permission to the Hindu population to establish its own chair of theology at the Indian University in Durban. This was finally acceded to by the government, but the Reformed churches were furious, and some of them accused the government of compromise in a Christian republic to allow for a training center for Hindu theology to be set up in a country for that portion of the country's inhabitants that are still Hindus. You see the tension there, and I must say creates a very big problem, the difficulty of which in being resolved is not immediately apparent. So I don't want you to think that there's not a lot of resistance in South Africa and a lot of difficult decisions that are being made regarding the further expansion of Christian and Calvinistic education in that land. I'd now like to say something about some of the products of education, and particularly the arts and the sciences. You are all aware, of course, that in the sciences, South Africa was the world's first to transplant the heart, which one may approve or disapprove of, depending on your theological evaluation of it. But in many other areas, there have been world breakthroughs in the sciences. South Africa is the only country in the world that has mastered the technique of producing uranium very, very cheaply. 10 years ago, there were hordes of American spies in South Africa trying to learn the secret of this, to produce the enriched uranium at a very, very cheap level. And, of course, South Africa is also the world's leader, as you know, in turning coal into gasoline. They have three or four huge plants, acres and acres and acres and mile after mile doing this. And right now, with the increasing economic crunch in the United States, American specialists are being trained in South Africa by South Africans into the technique of doing this as a possible means of coming back to the United States and doing something similar in the States to alleviate the increasing contrived or artificial or real oil shortage in the United States. And so too, I would point out that of all of the faculties of atomic energy in South African universities, the very best faculties of atomic energy at the universities are all chaired not just by Christians, but by dedicated Calvinists, such as the son of Professor Hendrik Stoker, such as Dr. Lo Albert, such as Dr. A.S.A. Rue, and others, just to mention a few of them. But I'd like to say something, not so much about the physical sciences, and to that I could add, of course, gold technology and the deepest and most specialized mines in the world, and ventilation techniques and fast drill techniques, because the gold in South Africa is very deep and very inaccessible. But particularly, I'd like to say something about the arts, with which you may not be familiar. A few words about the Afrikaans language. It's a very interesting language. I suppose you can say that Afrikaans is based upon 17th century southern Dutch mixed with Western German. German is spoken in the west of Germany, with strong admixtures from the French Huguenots, Scandinavians, and far more recently, English, and with minimal traces of words derived from contacts with non-whites in Africa and to a lesser extent from Indonesia. You mix all that together in a pan and stir it at 360 degrees and bake it, and three centuries later, what comes out in an indigenous form is Afrikaans. Afrikaans is the only Indo-Germanic language in the world to have developed outside of Europe. It is the only Indo-Germanic language ever to have developed in Africa. And it's also the most modern, I hate to use this word, almost computerized language in the world. It hardly has any inflections or strong forms whatsoever. And it is a tailor-made, specialized language to convey the maximum of content with a minimum of phraseology. Professor Gaffin of Westminster Theological Seminary, who reads Afrikaans quite well, told me it's a very, very neat language, especially in theology. I'd like to give you some interesting samples of Afrikaans literature, trying to render them in English, and of course it loses a great deal in translation. I've already mentioned the figure of the great Tosius and his poem on the ox wagon, the white child of South Africa treks further on into the land. He also wrote an excellent essay on the service of mercy of the deacons and another book on a few basic principles of Calvinism. Then there was Professor Pellissier, P-E-L-L-I-S-S-I-E-R, who wrote on music and on religious psychology. The great and well-known writer D.F. Malherbe, M-A-L-H-E-R-B-E, the latter two names, of course, French Huguenot names, who has written on national relations, beautiful poems on the history of Deborah and Sisera, on Amos, and on the game between black and white. Also, Dr. G.M. Dekker, D-E-K-K-E-R, who has written a manual on Afrikaner national culture and Afrikaner literature. The great poet who died just a few months ago, W.E.G. Lowe, L-O-U-W, who wrote on art and the future. J. Abel Kutsi, who wrote on the traditional Afrikaner style of life, and of course, N.P. Van Wyck Lowe, L-O-U-W, the brother of W.E.G. Lowe, who has written what is regarded by Germanic language specialists everywhere, and especially in Europe, as the greatest saga written in any Germanic language from Icelandic, German, Scandinavian, Dutch, English in the 20th century. Let me give you a few examples. My favorite Afrikaans poet is Jan F.E. Celiers. That is C-E-L-L-I-E-R-S. He wrote a poem about 70 years ago on a little bonfire that he had kindled in the veld, in the fields. And here's my attempt to translate this beautiful poem. My little fire and I are on watch. My little fire and I alone. I know that there are parties tonight in many a bright hall, but no one misses me at the dance and the feasts, banished, forgotten, estranged. But even so far from the crowds, in my lonely habitation, I feel at one with the Lord alone, a child in his bosom contented. Another mighty poem that he wrote about the desert scenes of southern Africa, with the huge rocky mountain sticking up out of the desert plains, goes as follows. Stone cities in the silent night. erect their rockeries of might, and bitterness melts through the sand. May no laugh or sigh of pain escape from pillar or from stone. With all thy peace around me here, God whispers with his still small voice and sparkles from his southern cross. The southern cross is a constellation of stars in the shape of a cross, which is only seen in the southern hemisphere. And incidentally, the star in what is the head of the cross was described by Her Majesty's Astronomer Royal, Sir William Herschel, the discoverer of the planet Uranus, who was stationed in Cape Town for many years. He said this star in the head of the cross, the southern constellation, was the bloodiest, reddest star that he'd ever seen anywhere in the skies. God put it in the head of the southern cross. And again, so ye, O land of love, here taste I peace, where stone towns in the silent night erect their rockeries of might, and bitterness melts through the sand. Also, the great poet C. Louis Leipoldt, L-E-I-P-O-L-D-T, who was born and raised not far from where my wife is now visiting her parents in South Africa. He returned as a very famous pediatrician from Cape Town and picked up a handful of gravel and some shriveled up, dried old leaves where he had grown up. And he looked at them and he wrote these words, translated, "A handful of gravel and dried up leaves tell me so much of those wonderful years when the world of the Hantam Mountains was the whole world for me. But today, I am as rich as a king." And then there's the great Eugene Marais, M-A-R-A-I-S, who, by the way, has written, according to Robert Ardrey, the American writer of African Genesis, quite the best study of the behavior of ants in the world. Also wrote a beautiful poem about the winter's night on the rolling fields and plains of the Transvaal State. And just some of those words are to this effect: it is cold and the wind is thin and the fields stretch out as wide as the mercy of the Lord. Wide as the mercy of the Lord. Nice to hear the wideness of God's mercy coming from Calvinists who are not always appreciative of the wideness of that mercy. Anyway, one could go on, but that's just to give you something of a flavor of some of the more important literature that appeals to me in the Afrikaans language. Now, coming to the more plastic and visual arts, the Afrikaners have been rather sternly Calvinistic. For many, many decades, they have been going into still art, painting things like fruit in a bowl, and especially the wide open spaces in the Rocky Mountains of the uninhabited areas of the country. Great writers, great painters like Pierneef, P-I-E-R-N-E-E-F, the more classic school. And then you have poetry such as Gerdener's Elijah and these other works that I referred to. And more recently, the work of the great preacher-poet, a classmate of mine, Isaac de Villiers, D-E-V-I-L-L-I-E-R-S, who is perhaps being regarded as the finest contemporary poet in South Africa, and whose works, written not just from a Calvinist perspective, but from a Calvinist preacher's perspective, as he ministers to the needs of his parishioners, are being very widely acclaimed. There were two rather amusing three amusing incidents in South Africa relating to sculptures and such like. One I told you about briefly the other day, when some Roman Catholic people tried to erect a crucifix on top of a mountain near Cape Town, and were ordered by the South African government to remove it as a desecration of public property. There was a tremendous degree of furore some 15, 20 years ago in South Africa when a public building that was being completed commissioned one of the famous sculptors in South Africa to try to represent medical welfare. I think it was a medical welfare center, improving people's health nationally. And he created a family of people, stark staring naked, a father and the mother and the little child in quite robust health and looking ahead. And the idea was to embellish the building with this figure. And it caused such a tremendous grassroots reaction to it, particularly the nakedness of the woman in this threesome, that in the end the bickering became so acrimonious that I believe the statue was finally removed. But at first, rather amusingly, they had a sheet up there draping it over to spare it from public eye. The kind of thing that could only happen in South Africa today. And then there was a Jewish painter who painted and publicly exhibited a very objectionable oil canvas that he had rendered of a figure nailed to a cross with a donkey's head on it and a Christmas cap on top of the donkey's head, and underneath it the words, "I forgive you, Father, you didn't know what you were doing." It was, of course, a blasphemous attempt to ridicule our Lord Jesus, and that led to a court case, to the removal of this work of art, if such it can be called, and to threats on the life of this Jewish artist who fled to Israel, and the work is no longer exhibited. I'm not defending any of these ways of handling it. I'm just giving you some idea of the flavor of the country and its tastes, at least up to the time when I left it. I suppose I need to say something about race relations. This seems to be the most interesting aspect to the non-South African of what is going on there. Well, I've said something already, so I'll be brief. In Genesis 1:28, South Africans understand the Bible to be teaching that God told Adam, the forefather of the human race, to be fruitful and to multiply and to fill the earth. And that as he had done this, and some of his descendants would have gone to have settled in Europe, others in Africa, others in Asia, others in North and South America, and finally Australia, why the various different races of man would have come into being. Race is not regarded in South Africa by Calvinists as being a consequence of the curse or of sin. It is regarded as being an intensification of the genes and the genetic possibilities and combinations which would have arisen even had man never fallen into sin by means of selective breeding, as people of certain genetic compositions had gone and lived in different parts of the world in isolation from one another and interbred only with their own kind. So a white South African would certainly agree that black is beautiful and that white is beautiful too. All colors are made by God. Well now, on the basis of Genesis 1:28, man unfortunately did fall into sin, and this led to an intensification of the genes and perhaps two of the differences which have now developed between man and man, and that God at the Tower of Babel, Genesis 11, did indeed split the human race that wanted to hang together and to build the first United Nations organization tower, scraping up to God and denying that God existed. As the text tells us, let's build a tower and a city, lest we be scattered over the face of the earth. But God had purpose to scatter them over the face of the earth, and so he came down and twisted their tongues, accelerating the process of the development of language, which I think would have developed in any case, and drove them apart into the different areas of the world. And then in Deuteronomy 32, verse 8, Afrikaner Calvinists will tell you it specifically states that when God divided the nations, he did so according to the number of the tribes of Israel. In other words, the segregation of the nations by God into the different tribes and nations took place so as to promote the expansion of the covenant people, who, of course, since the Great Commission of our Lord Jesus, are now an international covenant people. They would also point out that on the day of Pentecost, this process was not reversed. Pentecost is not the opposite of the Tower of Babel, as the liberals teach us. If it were, what would have happened at Pentecost is that everyone would have spoken in the same language, possibly Hebrew, and there would have been a return to the monolingual situation which did obtain in the world before Babel. But instead we find at Pentecost a sanctification of the cultural differences and a maintenance and further development and a Christianization of them and an enrichment of them. And so Pentecost, far from being a return to Babel, is a mighty push forward of the cultures of the world towards its ultimate goal in the church prior to the second coming, and especially in the church on the new earth after the second coming, Revelation 21, 24 through 26, when the nations of them that are saved shall bring the honor and the glory of the nations into the city of God on the new earth in terms of Christ's great commission linked to the cultural mandate to go forth therefore into all the world, turning all nations as nations into my disciples and teaching those nations, maintaining their God-given nationhood, to observe all things whatsoever Christ, the second person of the Trinity, had ever told them. Well, so much for the theology of the basic Calvinistic Afrikaner approach to race relations. Of course, this does not imply that whites are superior to blacks or vice versa, but they are all formally equal, the one and the many. Different, but equal. And yet, completely equal in the sense of all descending from Adam, all being saved by the blood of the second Adam. But of course, at this time in history, not yet have all nations in the world become Christianized to the extent that other nations have so far been Christianized in the world. The Afrikaner has been much more Christianized at this stage of his development than have, for example, the Zulu nation, a black nation in Africa. And even the Afrikaner nation needs to be much more greatly Christianized in the future than he has been up to this stage. And it is the different disparities at the stages of Christianization of the nations which, of course, creates some of the tension, not only in South Africa, but throughout the world, and especially in those countries where disparate cultural groups of people coexist alongside of one another. Well, now, in 1658, just 6 years after the arrival of the first white colonists, a fence was erected between where the whites were staying and the yellow-skinned Hottentot tribes were staying on the other side of the fence. From 1660 through 1760, Indonesian slaves were imported, seeing there were no blacks perceived by the whites in South Africa until 20 years after that in 1780. From 1780 to 1850, there were frontier clashes in the eastern part of South Africa between the Afrikaner Calvinists and the various black tribes, notably the Khoisans, and then also toward the tail end of that, the fierce Zulu nation. In 1852, the colored churches themselves requested to be allowed to secede from the white General Assembly and to create their own colored General Assembly. In 1930, political legislation was launched to increase the separation of the cultures, but also the advance of each culture in its own area toward political maturity and, as far as possible, towards Calvinization. In 1961, the Republic of South Africa was re-established, and the black-governed areas of the country, the Bantustans, as they are called, were developed towards complete political autonomy over against the white government of South Africa. And at the moment, the following black areas of different black tribes have that political independence which is recognized by white South Africa, namely the Transkei, the Ciskei, Zululand, Bophuthatswana, Kwakwa, Lobolo, Gazankulu, and Zenderland. From 1975 onward, consultation has been increasing at a tremendous pace between the white South African government and these now autonomous black states that I've just mentioned, which have advanced quite a distance toward Christian maturity, though not yet far enough. And the prognosis for the future would seem to be the confederation of South Africa ultimately as a loosely associated system of black and white states on the basis of formal equality, reflecting the ontological trinity, the one and the many, with the ultimate establishment of a United States of Christian Southern Africa. At least, I would hope so, and I would see this as the fulfillment of Isaiah chapter 2. And I think that will come to pass if the outside world, and notably Russia and China and the United States and Britain and France and Germany, would just adopt a more patient attitude to what the South Africans are trying to achieve of all colors in working out their own common destiny. A last word or two about the economic situation in South Africa. From 1658 onward, the Dutch East India Company started to make a profit from its enterprise in the Cape. It was, however, chiefly an agricultural profit because the real basic impetus toward the establishment of the colony in South Africa was to grow raw green vegetables and fresh fruit to give to the Dutch merchantmen on their ships in the long journey from Holland to Indonesia to combat the scurvy to which they were then subject on account of a lack of fresh fruit and vegetables by the time they reached where Cape Town is. And so the wealth during this time period that developed was chiefly agricultural wealth. And there was, to some extent, the rise of a landed gentry who, however, never had political control in the Cape. From 1700 to 1800, we find the development on a small scale of local businessmen and commerce in South Africa. From 1800 through 1860, with the dislocation involved through the arrival of the British, we find the Afrikaners trekking away and pioneering the areas to the east and to the north as hunters and ranchers keeping their livestock on the move. But especially from 1860 onward, with the discovery of diamonds and then gold, huge wealth began to develop in South Africa, so that today some of the wealthiest multi-billionaires in the world are found in that country. From 1900 to 1935, after the South African War, the white South Africans were defeated, economically ruined, and a very massive amount of them became impoverished poor whites with very little to lose but their chains, as Karl Marx might have said about them had he been more sympathetic and lived at that time. But then with the establishment of the economic rehabilitation schemes, such as Dr. John Castell's Reddingsdartsbond, which I described to you earlier, and then later the Bruderbond, which was established by Afrikaners particularly to contrive to bring about the economic resurrection of the Afrikaner, we find the development of large Afrikaner commercial enterprises such as Volkskas, the banking system, Federale Mynbou, or Federal Mines Incorporated, until the Afrikaner has more and more begun to achieve economic clout in his own land. One of the previous state presidents, Dr. Diedrichs, taught economics at the Orange Free State University, was also an authority against communism, and he and Senator Horwood, the present Minister of Finance, previously rector of the University of Natal, have more and more been steering South Africa away from the remnants of a certain amount of economic state socialism toward private enterprise, so that today It may possibly be so that South Africa is the freest country in the world as far as private enterprise is concerned, and in some areas, even ahead of the U.S. in terms of the theory, only, of course, because of the continuing socialization of the American economy, particularly the last 50 or 60 or 70 years after a position of free enterprise previously. At any rate, I think it's interesting that there are only a handful of countries in the whole world that produce enough food to feed themselves and to export to others. One, of course, is the U.S., the second is Canada, and then, fascinatingly, the two desert countries, Australia and South Africa, possibly Argentina. And after that, you have to scratch your head to find countries that can feed themselves, quite apart from those that have massive agricultural exports. I think there is a direct relationship between historic Calvinism's influence in a nation's origin and continued existence on the one hand, and its ability to produce and to keep on producing, especially in the area of agriculture, on the other hand. But last, I must disclose that South Africa is also a mineralogical power, perhaps the most supreme mineralogical power in the world. And of course, here I'm not referring so much to the production of gold, some 75% of the free world supply, or of diamonds, 90% of the free world supply, or platinum, a necessary ingredient and silencers on motor cars, some 95% of the world's supply, or copper, a huge slice of the world's supply. But here I'm referring to far more crucial minerals than those. I am referring to those rare metals which are absolutely essential for the manufacture of steel. I am referring to chrome, up to 90% of the world's supply. I am referring to cobalt, 77% of the world's supply. I am referring to antimony. I am referring to vanadium, molybdenum, manganese, and other vital ingredients which you must have to manufacture steel. Now, in addition to all of those, with South Africa controlling the vast majority of the percentage of world supplies, you have to have iron to manufacture steel. And some of the biggest deposits of iron in the whole world are in South Africa. Japan, almost devoid of steel, and certainly devoid of these other rare metals that you need to manufacture steel, imports vast quantities of iron and these metals from South Africa, so that Japan is now vastly ahead of the United States, Western Germany, the Soviet Union, and Britain in the manufacture of huge steel items such as ships. Most ships in the world today, more ships are being made by Japan than any other nation, and most of it made with South African iron and steel. Now, the United States does not need South African iron because the United States has sufficient iron. But the United States, as the producer of 45% of all of the wealth in the world, desperately needs South African cobalt, chrome, vanadium, molybdenum, manganese, and these other steel ingredients. The situation is so crucial that American steel kings in Pittsburgh and elsewhere have said that South Africa can survive without the United States. Not that South Africa wants to, but that the United States will self-destruct without South Africa. I find it hard to believe, and yet I'm assured by American steel producers that this is the case. And so, very frankly, the choice that confronts the United States on the world scene today is threefold. It can either stand by and do nothing and watch South Africa slug it out alone against the whole world in general and the Soviet Union in particular, and face the possible ultimate loss of all of that cobalt and manganese and steel to the Soviet Union, or at any rate, no longer to be supplied to America. If that happens, America will die, less importantly, after South Africa has died. That's the first choice that confronts the United States. The death of America through American inaction to protect and to ensure the flow to America of the South African minerals. The second thing that can happen is for the United States to aid and abet a possible Soviet takeover of Southern Africa with the same result, namely in the permanent shift of economic and industrial might permanently and irrecoverably away from the United States to the Soviet Union, with South Africa finally becoming a Soviet satellite and all of these beautiful raw materials falling into the hands of the Soviet. A third possibility that would confront an intelligent American president would be immediate American war against South Africa, annexation of South Africa, and forcible incorporation of South Africa into the United States as a 51st state. In that way, control of these vital metals would be ensured to the United States. But however attractive that may seem pragmatically, I think it would lead to the universal condemnation of America by the rest of the world and be counterproductive. Which leaves one with the only other alternative, and that is to start to reconstruct the excellent relationship that used to obtain between the United States and South Africa before Lyndon Johnson and more recently Jimmy Carter and his satellites rocked the boat and have brought about a very tense situation of international relation between the two. And that is to recognize the sphere sovereignty of the United States and of South Africa, and to work toward a policy of good neighborliness and of borrowing and sharing with one another and promoting international trade as we both work toward an increased Christian presence throughout the world. Thank you.